All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
The court is very pleased to conduct arguments for the first time ever at Austin College, and we would like to extend our appreciation to the administration and to the students and to the faculty for their assistance in making this a very enjoyable trip, and we hope very educational for the students and for the community. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050916, Pleasant Glade Assembly of God, Reverend Lloyd A. McCutcheon, Rod Lindsay, Holly Lindsay, Sandra Smith, Becky Bickle, and Paul Patterson versus Laura Schubert from Tarrant County and the Second Court of Appeals District. And docket number 060005 in the matter of HV from Tarrant County and the Second Court of Appeals District. Justice Harriet O'Neill is sitting in each of these cases, but could not be present today, but she will review the arguments before consideration of the case. The court is allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website sometime this week. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050916, Pleasant Glade Assembly of God and Others versus Laura Schubert.
May it please the court, Mr. Prusner will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I appreciate the fact that this is a historic moment, not only for this educational institution, but for this court. It's my pleasure to represent the Assembly of God Church, Pleasant Glade, its pastors and its members. These are good people. These are not people that have some history of abuse.
This is not what the jury found, is it?
Not what the jury found. In fact, when you read the jury's verdict, it says false imprisonment and assault. Even to this day, I have to step back and say, my goodness, how did we get here? Look at what the Court of Appeals stated were the undisputed facts about what the most guilty person did. The jury found that, you know, it apportioned fault, and it found that the most guilty person, 50% of the fault, and lesser percentages for other people, were Pastor Lloyd McCutcheon. And let's hear what the horrible thing was that he did. He wasn't even present on the Sunday night event when Laura was first held down, but on Wednesday night, he was there. He was summoned over after most of the events were over, and this is what the evidence was. When Pastor McCutcheon was summoned on Wednesday evening while Laura was being restrained, he simply put his hand on her forehead and played a tape of music to calm things down and eventually telephoned her father.
Well, you know, the jury's entitled to find otherwise, irrespective of what the evidence may show and irrespective of what one side believes the evidence should, or the conclusion of the jury should be. I'm concerned with this post-traumatic stress syndrome, how it's diagnosed, and whether or not a stricter standard needs to be applied when it's admitted into evidence.
Well, Justice Medina, to point to that specific point, the Court of Appeals applied a very liberal standard where they classified all damages that people win in personal injury cases as either direct damages that are automatically recoverable. You don't need to prove that they were foreseeable. You don't need to prove that anyone could even possibly contemplate them. You just automatically get them. And then there's consequential damages such as lost earnings, the things you have to especially plead and prove that they're foreseeable. And in this case, what the Court of Appeals did, unlike any other court in the United States, is they classified post-traumatic stress disorder in this first category, automatically recoverable. So that means that even a good faith tortfeasor, and that may sound like an oxymoron, but these people all acted in good faith. Everybody that came forward to help, not to hurt. And that's undisputed in this case. When Laura Schubert testified such things as why she was taken back to the Sunday school room, she said, they thought the kids were upsetting me, so they took me back there. She never ascribed an evil motive to these people, even a good faith tortfeasor. And it's probably going to surprise members of the audience that you can be a good faith tortfeasor. Even a good faith tortfeasor is automatically liable for post-traumatic stress disorder damages, a very scary precedent. For example, if one of the members of this audience was to leave, one of the men leave to go to the restroom, and he accidentally walks into the ladies' room and embarrasses some woman in there, well,
or himself,
probably post-traumatic stress disorder in both directions. Acting in good faith, made a harmless mistake, but he committed an intentional tort of trespass because he intended to go into that room. As soon as you intend to restrain somebody, you commit false imprisonment. Even if you think they stole your laptop and you tackle them, that's false imprisonment. When it turns out that actually that was their laptop, looks identical to yours, you're a good faith tortfeasor, but you are a tortfeasor. The Court of Appeals held that these post-traumatic stress disorder damages are automatically recoverable.
Counsel, as I understand the respondent's response to all this, the response is you're making too big a deal out of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is really a case where they have proved mental anguish damages. And there was testimony that the plaintiff suffered severe weight loss, had suicidal thoughts, fear of sleeping alone, inability to engage in activities that she previously enjoyed. So why wouldn't we analyze this under our typical law on mental anguish?
Well, Your Honor, I think that perhaps you may analyze it under the law, typical law of mental anguish damages. But before I get to that point, let me point out that post-traumatic stress disorder is nothing like typical mental anguish damages. That is, post-traumatic stress disorder, if you were to go into any psychologist or licensed professional counselor, anybody, a week after you've had a horribly traumatic event, even a rape, and described sleeplessness, all this, you would not get a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder because it has to be at least 30 days after the event, hence the name post-traumatic stress disorder. It has to be removed from the original trauma.
Yes, counsel, but let's say I agree with everything you're saying on post-traumatic stress disorder. I think it's not proved in this case. It is a theory that scientists hasn't really tied down, all of that. And let's assume I believe that's true. Isn't there evidence of mental anguish damages that would support the jury's award here?
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't believe that there is. Clearly, this case was tried under an entire theory of post-traumatic stress disorder. That is, post-traumatic stress disorder was mentioned and discussed 300 times during the trial. The opening and closing statements were all about post-traumatic stress disorder. We asked the trial judge to split off post-traumatic stress disorder from mental anguish. Let's split this out so that we can discuss it. Of course, we were also moving for a directed verdict that it shouldn't even be in there at all. But if you're going to put it in there, put it separate so we can discuss it separately. Well, the trial judge refused to exclude post-traumatic stress disorder damages, and he refused to separate it from mental anguish damages.
So there's no evidence of suicidal thoughts in this case?
Your Honor, there is evidence of suicidal thoughts in this case.
And is there evidence of weight loss?
Yes.
Fear of sleeping alone?
Fear of sleeping alone?
A substantial disruption in her daily routine?
There is.
This is evidence that we have said is the key evidence for mental anguish damages, and so that's why I'm asking, isn't there some evidence of mental anguish?
There is evidence of, well, I hesitate to use the term mental anguish, Your Honor, when, for example, Laura Schubert engages in an argument with her husband over whether he'll stop playing video games, and he refuses, and she goes in the bathroom and cuts herself with a knife and has self-mutilation, and then she says, this is years after the event, says, but that's all because of what happened at that church years ago. Personally, I have trouble saying, well, that's just mental anguish damages. To me, mental anguish is what you're experiencing during the event. Post-traumatic stress disorder is one step removed. Even in the psychological community, it has to be at least 1 month removed from the original trauma, or it doesn't get the label post-traumatic stress disorder.
How does a history of pre-mental disorders play into these diagnoses?
That's a good question, Justice Medina. If you don't tell your therapist about it, which Laura didn't, well, then they don't even know about the prior trauma that she suffered in Africa. So when her father wrote letters, which are a part of the record, and signed them, describing Laura as being so traumatized that she's rolled up in a fetal position in her bed for every moment that she's not doing homework, and this horrible trauma she experienced in her childhood, if you do not tell your therapist about that, the therapist knows nothing about it, takes the stand and testifies, as in Dr. Pensine, it was a deposition, so it wasn't actually at trial, and he was taken on direct and he said, well, Laura Schubert has post-traumatic stress disorder and it's from the events of the church. I cross-examined and say, you know, let's see what you're basing your diagnosis on. Do you know about all these horrible events in Africa? No, I didn't know about that. You say she was held for 2 weeks at the church and pummeled with fists. Yes, I have that right here in my notes, pummeled with fists. Here's her deposition. None of that happened. She wasn't held for 2 weeks. She wasn't pummeled with fists. Oh, well, maybe they're not good historians. They meaning Laura and her father. That's the nice way of saying maybe they're lying. So he ended this deposition with saying, you know, I'd want some harder evidence before I rendered a verdict, an opinion that a jury had based a verdict on. So what did the plaintiff's counsel do at trial? They simply got up and read from the first part of the deposition, where he was given a diagnosis under false information. And Justice Medina, you have hit the nail on the head. Your prior psychological histories in bad PTSD cases, I'm not talking about a valid one where a woman is raped or a gun's pointed in somebody's face. In a bad PTSD case, the people invariably conceal their prior problems from the therapist. And the therapist doesn't know any better. The therapist deals in a subjective world, and that's why you can get a post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis when you say that you've been abducted by aliens and taken to another planet.
So, counsel, it sounds like as to whether there's evidence of the stress disorder, you're making two arguments. One is, if there is some type of emotional disorder, it's caused by factors other than what happened at the church. And the other one is that the experts who testified that there was stress disorder that Laura was suffering from had bad data. So their opinions are not admissible or insufficient because it's based upon improper data, lack of complete history of what Laura suffered and her perhaps prior mental condition.
Yes.
What are the primary things that you contend were left off of the history that the experts on behalf of Laura didn't consider? The Africa missionary trip,
The Africa missionary experience, the fact that Joey, her brother, suffers from a nearly identical condition, agoraphobia. He would be afraid to walk in this room because he also has agoraphobia. He also couldn't finish high school and was on the homebound program. So when Laura Schubert and her family show up and talk to the therapist, do they ever say anything like, of course, brother Joey suffers from an identical psychological condition and has since kindergarten? Well, no. Well, that would sound like, gee, maybe there's something familial about this. So they simply excluded that.
So the brother did not have similar experiences at the church?
Actually, now he's had his psychological problems since kindergarten. But the morning of these events, at the morning service, brother Joey went to the floor of the church and stayed on the floor of the church so long that the older sister Amy had to call and cancel the lunch plans. And everybody put their hands on Joey and prayed over Joey, including Laura. It went on for hours. I'm sure for some people it was pretty bizarre.
Well, let's talk about that. Are churches, any type of church, but particularly churches that have a laying on hands, are they protected, or is there special protection that goes to those type of churches from these type of claims when the parishioners understand what the church is about and understand that they're going in there to be prayed for and that perhaps some of the ceremony would involve laying of hands and in this case perhaps some restraint where the pastor thought restraint was required based on his biblical understanding of the teachings? Is there a special protection that attaches to that, or?
Your Honor, I think the special protection only attaches to personal injury, meaning mental anguish claims. I don't believe it applies to bodily injury claims. Now, I made that statement at the Court of Appeals, and now they take it out of context. As to a bodily injury claim, if you commit bodily injury, whether it's a carpet burn or a scratch or you cut someone, you commit a bodily injury claim, I don't believe the First Amendment applies. But when you go to a personal injury claim, and I'm using Black's Dictionary law terms, despite the Court of Appeals taking my concession about the First Amendment not applying to bodily injury and using it as if I waived all my clients' rights, which is exactly what they did. But as to a bodily injury claim, injury to the body, I don't believe the First Amendment applies.
Did you have to argue that to the jury? I mean, the Court of Appeals also said in a footnote that you agreed that you wouldn't put any evidence on about why the church does this and what their practices are.
Your Honor, figuring out how you don't, judges, you guys love to find waiver. I'm sorry, y'all do, okay? As soon as I began to put on any kind of evidence about religious practices that even sounded like we kneeled down and laid hands on it, plaintiff's counsel would say, okay, they waived their First Amendment arguments to keep religion out of the trial. Now everything comes in about First Amendment, about what this church believes.
So you were trying to keep that
out?
We
were trying to, in order to enforce our First Amendment rights, we were trying to not bring religious materials into this case, what they believed, what they taught about demons. And keep in mind,
but that seems to be significant when you have, from what I've read here, this child at the time who was given over to her adult sister and to members of this church, which brings up another question I want to ask later. But they go in there and she's having these problems, apparently. That, to me, that's important for the jury to know what the actions of the members of the church were and why they did what was done.
Justice Medina, I wish I could tell you that there's a correct way to try one of these cases. If you start bringing in religious matters and say, well, listen, we believe in spiritual warfare, and so it was proper to pray for her, we believe she was actually under demonic attack and needs spiritual protection, that testimony is then subject to cross-examination along the lines of, isn't she a believer? And as a believer, isn't she free from being possessed by a demon? And then we would need to respond and say, you're free from being possessed, but you can still be oppressed. And you would end up having a religious trial, a trial about whether this was religiously appropriate. So it's very hard to figure out how to try a case. Keep in mind, why does this problem exist? The problem exists because the court has walked into the church. This is not a case where church members are going out trying to get some secular benefit and claiming they have a religious right. The courts have walked up the center aisle of the church and are inserting themselves between a pastor who laid his hand on someone's forehead, and we're going to litigate whether that's proper or not. We submit that that's okay to do as long as you simply require intent, some sort of intent to harm, and foreseeability of damages. Those elements are not present in this case.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. The reason why Laura Schubert was moved out of the main part of the church and into a room was because, and this is on the record, the members wanted to take away her audience and they thought this was a dramatic ploy. What was done to her was not done for religious reasons. There was waiver.
Wait. If in the middle of First Baptist Church service somebody stands up and starts shouting and you take them outside, why isn't that done for religious purposes? I don't want my First Baptist Church service disrupted by somebody shouting.
Well, the reason that was given by the parishioners was that they thought this was a dramatic ploy for attention.
Well, I'm sure it was. But if somebody stands up in here and starts shouting, we'll take them outside, and that'll be part of the judicial process, because we don't want this ceremony disrupted by somebody shouting. Why is that not part of their religious function?
Well, to me, it's just not, I guess.
Well, Let me ask about post-traumatic stress syndrome. Which symptoms of that syndrome could I not fake?
According to the expert testimony, it is possible to fake.
No, this is not. I know what the experts said,
okay. And
the people that believe in PTSD believe in it. My question is not, is there anybody believes in it? My question is, which symptom could I not fake if I wanted to?
Well, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so I don't think I can answer that
question. I'm asking
what
the evidence was at trial. Which one could I not fake?
Well, according to the experts, she didn't fake any of them.
That's not a symptom. I'm asking, it's an easy question. If there's no symptom, but you still believe in it, that's fine. I just want to know, is there a symptom, blood test, is there any physical, objective symptom of PTSD that cannot be faked? I couldn't lie about it, and you wouldn't
know. You mean successfully faked? Because it depends on the clinician that's doing the examination.
Or read a book and learn what the symptoms are and how it's diagnosed and try to make yourself fall under those symptoms.
That's an argument that's made by the petitioner. However, the book that was given to Laura Schubert was given to her after three doctors had already diagnosed her with PTSD.
Counselor, let's come back to your first point where you said that they did not take Laura out of the main sanctuary for religious purposes. So you think they took her outside of the main sanctuary with the intent of assaulting her? What do you think the purpose was for taking her out of the ceremony?
According to their testimony, they thought it was a ploy, that she was trying to fake some sort of a religious experience when that was in truth, in fact, not the case.
What should they have done?
What were they intending to do? What was the evidence that they were intending to do when they took her out of the ceremony, if it was not for religious purposes?
They were trying to get her away from the other kids, whom they thought were being disrupted by Laura Schubert being on the floor. And Laura Schubert was having medical issues. She did not want to be touched. She didn't want to be held down. She didn't consent to anything. She told them that. She fought, screamed, kicked as best she could, and they took her away.
I understand that. That happened
twice.
The first time on a Sunday and then on a Wednesday.
And our following on a Wednesday.
She didn't like it on the Sunday, I take it. She screamed, said, let me go on
That's
the Sunday.
Right.
Why did she come back Wednesday?
Well, the church pretty much was her life as a young lady, and the psychologist would tell you that you return to the place of the event to try and make sense out of it. And she was not understanding what was happening to her and could not believe that bad things could happen to somebody 17 years old in a church. Her father is a minister. And that is where they spend their time. Now, there was a question earlier about the reliability of the methodology that was used for determination of PTSD. And first let me say that the charge doesn't mention the word PTSD. It only goes to mental anguish and pain and suffering. It's in the same issue. It wasn't separated. It wasn't requested to be separated out. So much for pain and suffering, so much for mental anguish. There's all kinds of evidence of mental anguish, some of which was repeated here already, and to include fear of death.
Are those two different medical diagnoses?
They weren't medical diagnoses.
Well, it's a psych. Your brain's a part of your body. I don't understand why that's not a medical diagnosis. If some doctor says you have this syndrome or some other disorder of your brain.
Are you speaking as to why that was included in the same charge? Because that's what's in the Texas pattern jury charge. That's the way it is formatted. You can request as an attorney to have that separated out. That wasn't done. In other words, how much do you find for pain? How much do you find for mental anguish? It was amalgamated. It was how much do you find, what damages do you find for pain and suffering and for mental anguish? And it was $150,000. And what I'm saying, to pick up on a point that was made earlier, there's all kinds of evidence of mental anguish, to include fear of death, which appears at page 88 of volume 4 of her transcript.
But
she feared she was going to die.
But our concern on reliability is, if a person, you or I, get on the stand and say, I was in a car wreck and this hurt, and it was, I see cars coming at me, the jury makes an assessment of it. But our concern is that if you put several eminent psychologists, psychiatrists on the stand, who say this is worse than that, what she's got is a lot worse than that, and something she's going to have all of her life, the jurors who haven't been psychology majors or gone to medical school will give that undue weight. That's what we're concerned about in reliability. And so why is, if we can't, I'm not going back to my question on symptoms, how can we be sure, how could you do a test on this? How could you test to see whether clinicians actually are pinpointing a syndrome rather than just, you know, for this particular case, you need to give this person more damages than you normally would?
Two answers. One, the jury found no mental anguish in the future, which is some evidence in my mind that what they were awarding damages for was the mental anguish that had existed in the past, since there's nothing going forward, notwithstanding the fact that three experts said that she was suffering from PTSD
and would
in the future and needed medical attention in the future, and the jury awarded $16,000 for future medicals, but not for any PTSD. Now, the second part of that is that a clinician is heavily trained. Each one of these doctors is very well trained. There's no question about their credentials. They use several different tests, the CAPS, the Beck inventory, PSS, and the clinician interview, which is so important. That was all set forth for the trial court in 600 pages of deposition testimony, affidavits, that demonstrated the methodology that's used. And that methodology is to employ not just the clinician interview, which is the most important, but all these other tests that have backstops in them. And the clinician, who's so heavily trained, can determine whether somebody is faking. And there
so
are tests for faking good and faking bad.
Right, and they do some tests for that, and they catch some people. But in fact, if psychiatrists or psychologists could tell who's lying or not, we wouldn't need juries, would we?
Well,
just send them to the psychologist. We'll get some psychology professors up here, put them in the box.
Tell us
who's lying.
I don't think the court is saying that someone should not go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist to be
absolutely not.
To be looked at.
You're saying the question on reliability is, can we trust this? Is this trustworthy enough where we can tell a jury, ladies and gentlemen, you're not going to understand all these tests, but take this guy's word for it. This person's not lying.
Well, the methodology that was followed was that which is in the DSM-4 for all the symptomatology. That was followed assiduously. And each one of the experts, and there are something like 10 experts, but the three main ones said that they followed that and that she endorsed either all or most of those symptoms. Then, in addition to that, there were these other tests that in the articles that I presented to the trial court showed that 57 separate experts have endorsed those tests and that methodology as being the way and the right way to get to whether somebody is suffering from PTSD.
Counsel, in Likes, the case of Likes, we examined mental anguish damages, and we sort of put them in different categories when they're capable of being recovered. Cases where the defendant acted intentionally or with malice would be one, or cases where the plaintiff suffered serious bodily injury would be another, or cases where there's a special relationship such as doctor-patient.
Right.
In other contexts, we say mental anguish is recoverable when there's a shocking and disturbing incident and where mental anguish is a highly foreseeable result. Which of these categories does your case fall
in? Well, I think shocking and also assault.
And
assault
how about
and restraint.
How about highly foreseeable?
Highly foreseeable that somebody would suffer PTSD or mental anguish?
Either.
Well, I think it's clear that mental anguish, I mean, based on the cases, that the Likes case, that's a given at this point in our history.
No, I'm asking,
would it
be highly foreseeable to members of the church after they took this action, should they have it in their mind that this is likely to occur, that she will, as a result, have suicidal ideation?
I think it's highly foreseeable that she would suffer mental anguish. PTSD is a way in the resulting of PTSD is because people process, and different people process different symptoms, different injuries differently.
If it's highly foreseeable and should have been in this case, doesn't that mean that the churches of this nature who believe in this kind of activity for religious and spiritual reasons essentially cannot continue in that belief without threat of punishment by the civil law?
Well, I think it's clear from the constitutional law that conduct is not protected under the First Amendment.
To hone in on the question, I mean, wouldn't, if you were advising the Assembly of God churches, wouldn't you say if you continue to have people come down front and be touched and prayed over, you're risking judgment for assault?
Okay. There's a difference. What you're suggesting is consensual. And what I'm saying is that it was clear, abundantly clear, that this was not consensual Laura's behalf. For 2 hours.
I understand.
Twice.
But the risk would be to the church. The church would say, well, 2 hours, okay, but what about an hour and a half? What about an hour? What about 10 minutes?
Well,
what about somebody who was more vulnerable, less vulnerable? What about this? In other words, you're going to try your church practice before a jury anytime somebody feels that they've been suffered mental anguish.
Well, if, of course, the facts have to bear it out. And in this case, every one who testified, all those kids testified that they held her down. And they held her down for that period of time.
Yeah, let's talk about kids. You have a minor here.
Yes.
And obviously her parents were part of this church and left for some extended weekend for some reason. And left her.
They were a missionary.
Okay, left her in the hands of maybe the church and her sister. Who's going to make this decision for this minor child? If you have a 10-year-old or 11-year-old in there, or 17-year-old as in this case, that participates in this church activity, church stops when they're, it appears to me, responsible for that child while she's there.
They removed her to take away an audience. That was their stated purpose. They didn't need to continue to hold her down and hold her for a couple of hours.
Should they have called the police to get her out of there because she was disruptive?
Well, they might have taken her temperature or felt her pulse, gone through all that stuff, and they didn't. And Rod Lindsay was a nurse.
Counsel, they were praying over her. Apparently they believed that she had a spiritual problem. So regardless of whether they took her out to deprive her of an audience, apparently they had some misgivings about that because they believed apparently she had a spiritual problem, or they would not have been praying over it, seems like.
And it seems like we're going behind all of the evidence that was in this case that came before this jury, because none of that came before this jury, and the petitioners...
There's no evidence that they were praying over her?
No.
Okay. Now, but let me go to another question, if I might, and taking your statement at face value. There is, as I understand, there was a cross-examination and a challenge of an expert's testimony because the expert had used the demon possession aspect of maybe the beliefs of the church and Laura's beliefs as mixing into her disorder somehow. And am I remembering the transcript correctly on that?
Well, I I don't remember exactly the way you do, but there were several instances where each counsel was charged with the responsibility of redacting all references to religious conduct, activity, or anything along those lines. And we did the best we could. On one or two occasions, some of them solicited by counsel for the defense,
I didn't mean to go into what came in, but rather the question that I was going to was, as I understand, some of the expert testimony was challenged because the expert informing his opinion relied on a relation by Laura that she had demon ideations as part of the religious experience she had.
No, I think you're speaking about Dr. Helge, and Mr. Prusiner pressed him on a deposition on that, and Dr. Helge came back and said what gave her the PTSD was the assault and the restraint, not the words or anything else.
Does the record show exactly when and for what purpose her father gave her the book on PTSD?
Yes. Yes, it does. It shows February of 1997, and in beginning in November of 1996, she was diagnosed by three separate physicians, psychiatrists, as having PTSD. The only reason that the issue came up and that she got a book is because her father saw the notation of 309.81, whatever PTSD, the code for PTSD is, and he went to the library and got a book on it and provided it to Laura, but it's 4 months after.
Several months after she was diagnosed with PTSD.
Yes. And there isn't anybody in this case, there isn't any expert in this case that doesn't diagnose PTSD. Are they all wrong? Do they all get lied to? I don't think so. And I would say that there's waiver. I mentioned that before.
Well, before you go to waiver, let me ask you about the experts. Mr. Presser said that Pressner said that the experts, or at least some of them, did not have all the background knowledge and information they needed to reach an accurate diagnosis. And
they had everything.
And on which to base their expert opinion, permissibly at trial at least. Did the experts, and you referred to 10, but you said there were three primary experts.
Yes.
Did they all three know about the glycemia, about the Africa missionary trip, and the other things that Mr. Pressner says they needed to know about to give an accurate opinion?
Yes.
Is there anything that he argues about that they did not know? Are you taking the position that he's just wrong on the facts?
Yes, I'm saying that if you check the record carefully, and I tried to set the record straight in both my petition for review and the briefs of the court. I have long sections on setting the record straight.
You do have long sections on the record.
And you would have to go back. I mean, I can't possibly do it in 48 seconds. But the short answer is these doctors had the information, all the information available to them.
Does this term in loco parenti have any effect on this case? You have a minor that was left to...
I don't think so, and I would rely on what the Court of Appeals said along those lines. The cases are specific on it. She was not...
We don't always rely on what the Court of Appeals says, so that's why I asked the question.
I can't think of the name of the case that they relied on. McGee, I believe it was.
Let me...
Go ahead. Justice Wainwright. Board of Trustees of Bastrop Independent School District also seems to indicate that that theory expands to a teacher-student relationship, and should it not expand to a preacher-parishioner relationship?
Well, it was a temporary... supervisory condition is what they found. They didn't find there was any of the indicia that's needed for the finding of an in loco parenti finding.
Justice Wainwright?
I have to stop. I'm sorry I didn't get to answer that.
Just a short follow-up. How did the experts explain the glycemia and the missionary trip to Africa and possible trauma there? As when the argument was made that does not support their diagnosis.
Well, Laura Schubert has testified that there was no trauma in Africa. Her parents, her sister, her brother testified the same thing.
Her good friend said that she told her, however, that she saw killings and beatings and some traumatic things.
Plaintiffs always say it's the defendant's fault.
There's always
some other evidence, though.
I'm sorry.
Plaintiffs always say it's all the defendant's fault.
Well, Tracy Patterson also said, in connection with that same statement that you mentioned, Your Honor, that Laura had said she'd been in the hospital for twice. And the truth of the matter is that Laura was never in the hospital for the full 3.5 years from 1992 to 1996 when this happened. And Tracy Patterson, you weren't there, you didn't hear the evidence, but it was clear she was not telling the truth. And the jury found she wasn't telling the truth.
So there was just no traumatic incidents on the missionary trip?
On the missionary trip, Laura saw a snake as it slithered into the bush. Yeah, she saw somebody slapped.
I read that. So, but your position is there were no traumatic
incidents that she experienced
on the missionary trip?
Absolutely clear.
And the glycemia?
Hypoglycemia?
Yes.
Dr. Penzine.
Did she have that, or is that not true?
I don't know really the answer to that, because she did have something to eat that day, and Dr. Penzine was saying that he thought it was a case of hypoglycemia because she hadn't had anything to eat. Well, in truth and fact, she did have something to eat, and that was brought out at the trial. It was a piece of pizza, as I recall.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
The court will hear a rebuttal.
Thank you. Were these people who testified actually told about the Africa experience? Let me tell you how this worked out in litigation. We took Laura Schubert's, the entire Schubert's family deposition. How was Africa? Oh, it was wonderful. I'd raised my kids there. It was great. It wasn't until we went and subpoenaed the records from the denomination that we got Tom Schubert's handwritten letter where he pleads about his family's trauma, about how Laura's curled up in a fetal position, horrible trauma in Africa. And then we exposed this, and then some of the psychologists were given this letter. And
that's the flip side to what I said earlier. The defendants always say it was everybody else's fault, it wasn't mine.
Exactly.
And the jury, since they found against you, we have to presume that they found that the Schuberts were telling the truth.
But there's a difference in this case. And the difference is, in most cases, when you have a broken arm, it's pretty hard to change how your arm got broken. Mm-hmm. But when you have a mental injury, it's like trying to get your thumb on top of a bean that doesn't. For example, when this case was filed, the petition reads luridly how she was traumatized on Friday night by religious teachings.
Let me ask you a question here. It seems to be an issue of whether or not we should even invoke this religious issue into this case. Let's say someone has the privilege of coaching a young group of men for a baseball team, and these are all minors, and their parents drop them off to a baseball game, so the coach has an opportunity to coach them and makes a decision that one child isn't going to play, and the child wants to go on the field to disrupt things, and the coach decides to hold them back, restrain them, and during that little altercation, someone gets hurt. Does that coach subject himself now to a similar situation that you have here? And should that coach now believe that perhaps there's a foreseeability of a post-traumatic stress syndrome that this kid will never be able to play right field again?
If you were trying to invite somebody to join a Big Brothers or Big Sisters program or to help coach, you would need to tell that coach that the current state of the law under the Court of Appeals opinion is that they not only automatically subject themselves to liability for post-traumatic stress disorder, even if they act with good intent to help the kid, such as the kid says, you know, I'm through with baseball. I'm going to walk home. It's 2 miles, but I'm going to walk home. You say, to hell with you. You're sitting in that dugout. I'm going to make you sit in that dugout. You've committed intentional torts. You're automatically liable for post-traumatic stress disorder. And then here's the final thing. Insurance doesn't usually cover intentional torts. So you better tell this person that you're asking to volunteer that you'll face financial ruin. In this case, Pastor McCutcheon, 50% of the jury's verdict would have been $150,000.
I'm not clear on how the defendant thought that, or the defendants thought that this case could be tried without going into the religious practices.
The reason, Your Honor, and this was a hard decision. It was a hard decision. But the reason that we went along with the trial judge's decision to just cut out religion is that as soon as you brought up religion, you know, in our faith we lay on hands, you would automatically be injecting religion in and engaging in a waiver. This is what they were arguing.
Well, I understand, but the laying on of hands outside the church is called assault. And it seems to me that if you take it out of the context, if you say, well, this happened at 2 o'clock in the morning down on Main Street in the dark in an alley, then that's one thing. And if you say, well, it happened at church, it's something else.
I think that's why the United States Supreme Court said that in a First Amendment case, this court is supposed to review the entire record. When my opposing counsel says that there was no evidence that they were praying for, what he means is there was no evidence in front of the jury they were praying for. But the Court of Appeals below took judicial notice of the other proceeding, the mandamus proceeding, which was all about prayer. The deposition of Laura Schubert, where she talks about, when I was hallucinating on the floor of the church, I was screaming about demons. I was talking about demons trying to get me. I had a vision I wanted to tell the church members about. All of that religious thing is in the record. It wasn't in front of the jury. And this court, under the First Amendment, is commanded to read the entire record.
But you can waive your First Amendment rights.
Your Honor, when we object at every point under the First Amendment, and we're told that if we bring up religion and bring up our religious beliefs, then guess what? We don't just get to tell our side. They get to introduce. And keep in mind, this is how this controversy started, was Tom Schubert filed a religious complaint with the denomination saying, they shouldn't have been praying for my daughter this way. She's a believer. She couldn't be affected by demons. And they were saying, well, we weren't trying to do an exorcism, so it was permissible. It started off as a religious dispute. If we had taken that dispute into court and started putting on evidence of the religious belief, Tom Schubert would say, well, I'm a pastor. I get to tell my version of the religious belief. And then what does the jury do? Say, well, you know, you guys were or were not acting according to the tenets of your faith. That's a heresy trial.
Is it correct that none of the defendants brought their own experts to trial? You relied on the cross-examination of the plaintiff's experts?
That's correct. And the reason we did, Your Honor, this goes back to that same issue about if we start bringing in our explanation of what was affecting her psychologically, we were concerned about whether we open it up to a large cross-examination. In the in loco parentis thing, I realize we've received short shrift here today. Without in loco parentis, you commit an intentional tort as soon as you pull a kid off the field and say, you're not playing baseball anymore, you're sitting in that dugout.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions? The cause is then submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Thank you.
All rise.